Today I'm here to talk about 1994. 94 was a pretty monumental year. For me, I got my PhD in political science and I left the United States to go to Romania. O.J. Simpson was arrested for the murder of his wife. The Beastie Boys released Ill Communication, one of the greatest records that's ever been released. Kurt Cobain sadly committed suicide. Quentin Tarantino released Pulp Fiction and Friends premiered on NBC. And of course, for today's purposes, the Republican Revolution occurred in 1994. It's also known as the Contract with America. What happened in 1994 in that midterm election was control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate flipped from Democratic control to Republican control. And not only did that end 40 straight years of Democratic control of the House of Representatives, it brought to an end, we now know this, we didn't know it at the time, but we now know it brought to an end the 60-year era of Democratic dominance of politics. Since the 1932 election, Democrats had dominated American politics. The 1932 election changed the party system from a Republican-dominated system. The Republicans had dominated American politics since 1860. The 1994 election ended a party era and started what is now the divided party era. Neither party is dominant. The Republicans hoped that it would start an era of Republican dominance, restart. Democrats hoped that it was a blip. It was neither a blip, nor was it the start of a Republican era. The 1994 election was different. The election of 1860, which started the era of Republican dominance, 1860, climax of the sectional conflict over slavery, and it was the election that resulted in the Civil War. Obviously, a pretty crisis-driven election, 1860. 1932 was the first presidential election after the Great Depression, and with 3 years of Republican neglect of the suffering that was going on, it swept into power. The only president who's ever been elected 4 times, Franklin Roosevelt, as well as an enduring Democratic majority in Congress. From 1932 to 1994, the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for all but 4 years. 2 years during the presidency of Harry Truman and 2 years during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. In both of those cases, the Republicans took over the House and the Democrats took it back in the very next election cycle. Out of 62 years, 58 years of a Democratic House, with majorities averaging over 100 seats. So a significantly dominant era. The 1994 election was not a crisis election. 1994 was not only a midterm election instead of a presidential election, it was an election that took place as the United States was coming out of the Cold War and was coming out of a recession. The incumbent president, Bill Clinton, was suffering a little bit because of the failure of his healthcare reform effort and the sort of controversy surrounding the don't ask, don't tell policy about gays in the military, but his approval rating started the year at 58%. And in fact, at the time of the election, it was in the low 40s, which is pretty decent. Presidents typically, historically, I think a lot of people who follow American politics know this piece of common wisdom, typically in their first midterm election of their first term, their party loses seats in Congress. The 1994 election, however, was a historical rout for the Democrats. They lost 54 House seats and 8 Senate seats. The 60-year average was of midterm losses is 22, and the Senate is 2.5. So the losses that the Democrats suffered in the 1994 election were double and triple the historical average. It was even worse than the 1974 Watergate midterm election, where Republicans lost 48 House seats and 5 Senate seats. Bill Clinton and the Democrats in 1994 managed to do worse than the post-Watergate Republicans. The question is, how did this happen? What I want to talk about today is how it happened, and then what the consequences have been. The big picture consequence is that it ended 60 years of Democratic dominance and started an era of divided government. And we've lived under divided government since 1994, 60% of the time, which is 50% higher than the average since 1860, since the onset of the modern party system. So if you feel like we've had more divided government over the past 30 years, you're right. That's not just a feeling, that the facts actually bear that out. The Republicans did an amazing thing, right? Not only did they make Bill Clinton and the Democrats look worse than the post-Watergate Republicans, in order to flip the House and the Senate, they had to flip a lot of seats. The Democrats in the House had an 82-seat majority going into the 1994 election. They needed to flip 42 seats in order to have a net gain of more than 82. In the Senate, the majority for the Democrats was 57-43. Which is not filibuster proof, but is pretty solid, particularly in modern terms. So that would require, because there was a Democratic vice president to break ties, that would require flipping 8 Senate seats. And there are only 33 or 34 Senate elections in any given cycle, so that was a lot of flips. The Republicans resoundingly flipped the House, and just barely with the 8 seats were able to flip the Senate. How did they do it? It was a combination of good old-fashioned politics with a brand new playbook. And the brand new playbook was the Contract with America. The brand new playbook involved overturning a few established verities of American political campaigning. But first, I'll just talk about what they did that was typical. The typical way to campaign for the out party is to attack the president and the majority party in Congress, to, whenever possible, obstruct the majority party from getting things done, so you could say to the American people, these bozos don't deserve to govern, we deserve to govern by default. That was the traditional fashion, and that is still very traditional to do. In fact, it's even deepened in its usefulness. But what the Republicans did was they combined the traditional negative obstructionist playbook with a positive nationalized legislative campaign, which had never been done before. One of the previous speakers of the House, Tip O'Neill, very famous guy in Democratic circles, his memoir was called All Politics is Local. He was not just making a sort of a claim about what it should be, he was saying that's what it's like. And one of the reasons why the Democrats won year after year for 60 years is they campaigned on local issues, and they campaigned towards that local constituency. There was not a national legislative platform that the Democrats ran on. There was a platform for the presidential campaign. The Democrats stood for certain things, but candidates and the party leaders didn't stand up and say, if you elect us to the majority, this is what we're going to do. And in fact, for 60 years, the Democrats held, with a couple of exceptions, they held the majority, so they didn't really have to campaign on anything other than just keep returning us. But they focused on local races. What Newt Gingrich and the Republicans who were in the House hoping to take over, and with this tall hill to climb, they had to flip 42 House seats and 8 Senate seats, is they said, we're going to actually overthrow the idea that all politics is local, and we're going to come up with and campaign on a nationalized legislative platform, a positive platform. Political verity number one, conventional wisdom, all politics is local. Throw that out, nationalize this campaign. Political verity number two is don't paint a target on your back by offering specifics. We've lived 30 years in a different political era, and we've lived for, I would say, the last 20 years in an era where politicians say very specific, very powerful, outrageous things. And so it's easy to forget that for a really long time, politicians' primary reputation was as weasels who said nothing. They were evasive, they were vague, they wouldn't offer specifics. And that's because political verity number two was don't paint a target on your back. And it makes sense. If you say you're for something, that's going to win some people. But it's way easier to lose people with specifics. Because if you offer a 10-point plan, all it takes is 1 or 2 points to make somebody hate it. All it takes is points 5 and 6 to make someone else hate it. And so the idea is if you're too specific, you're going to actually just give away little chunks of support on people who will hate part of what your plan is. If you don't think this is how things go, just think about what happened with the Affordable Care Act and how that turned off an awful lot of progressives and left-leaning Democrats and left-leaning moderates. It didn't have their favorite thing. It didn't have a public option. It didn't have Medicare for all. It had too many giveaways to the insurance industry. Overall, it might have been a plan that a lot of people would have liked and has done a lot of good, but it had a lot of details. And the 2010 midterm election was proof of what everybody who thought about politics already knew, which is the more specific you are, when you have a big legislative accomplishment, it's going to piss off groups of people, and those groups of people add up. You don't often win back. If somebody hates points 1 and 2 of your plan, you don't win them back with points 5 and 6 being stupendous for them. For some people, they could look at a 10-point plan and say, I hate 2 of those points, but I'm going to vote for it anyway. That's not something that never happens, but it's not the common human psychology. The Republicans were betting on the fact that they could actually run a campaign with specifics. And the Contract with America had a lot of specifics. Now, it was well-crafted because there were 3 basic pillars of the Contract with America. One was a set of ethics reforms for Congress. This was a direct response to the fact that Democrats had been suffering from scandals since 1989, running through the 1994 election. A lot of Democrats were corrupt or semi-corrupt or cheating on their wives or having sex with their staff members or using the Postal Service to commit banking fraud. There were a lot of different things that Democrats were doing that had come out. And so the Republicans, knowing that this was a weakness for Democrats, also realized that they could capitalize on that with a positive platform for ethics reform. And those ethics reforms were extraordinarily popular with the American people. So it wasn't one of those things where it was going to be chipping off any kind of support for you by offering those specifics. Ironically, as some of you probably know, many of the Republican leaders who came to power in the 1994 election got caught up in ethics scandals of their own, running afoul of the very same ethics reforms that they had put into place. And by the end of the 90s, nearly everybody who was on the contract team, the leadership team with Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay and others, had left Congress in some version of shame or scandal. Just a nice little irony there. If you're going to run against corrupt people, either don't make ethics reforms or make sure you're cleaner than they were. And, you know, like, it's tough to do both of those things. The other pillar was a set of procedural reforms to Congress, which can sound very dry and very insidery baseball, but one of the things that was true of Congress back then, it has become double, triple, quadruple true, is that Americans routinely hate on Congress and think Congress is broken. Congressional approval ratings right now are in the teens, and actually I think the mid-teens is pretty good for now, like compared to where it's been. Congressional approval ratings in 1994 were at a peak of 29% and a low of 23%, which today would be good. Today would be like almost stellar, but back then that was pretty bad. And that reflects the fact that most Americans thought Congress was broken. So the contract Republicans said, we're going to fix Congress. We're going to reform Congress. Now, a big part of this, and this was a positive vision. It was speaking to dissatisfactions that the American people had. The procedural reforms were, when polled, just as popular as the ethics reforms. This was unironically, like the ethics reforms were ironically trapping the Republicans in the future. This was kind of the insider baseball that transformed American politics in a really profound way. Basically, the procedural reforms were intended not to fix Congress, but to shift power from committee chairs and committees onto the party leadership in each chamber, and it succeeded in doing so. And we have a leadership-centric Congress, and have had a leadership-centric Congress since 1994. The third pillar was a conservative policy agenda, which was the riskiest, but most of the features of the conservative policy agenda that involved rolling back the social safety net and reducing economic regulations, they polled pretty well and they were relatively popular, largely because at that point, Democrats had been running policy for 60 years on the New Deal Great Society model, and Americans were justifiably sort of fed up with big government. 2 years later, President Bill Clinton, a Democrat, declared the era of big government is over. That's supposed to be a Republican talking point, but he picked that up because the contract Republicans were onto something with their policy agenda. That was the riskiest part, and it was the part that they actually succeeded the least on, and it's the part of the nationalized legislative agenda that has been dropped by future party leaders as the most risky, offering specifics for ethics reform, anti-lobbying reform, procedural reform, things that fix Congress kind of from the inside. That remains popular and relatively frequent. It's easy for the out party to play on Americans' hatred of Congress by saying, we're going to fix Congress. The out party, because of the way things are set up in Congress, particularly with the leadership-centric form of legislating, can obstruct relatively easily, and so you can frustrate Americans with Congress even more so than ever. Like, we're living through a period where it's become almost absurd. Almost like if you'd shown me the movie of Congress, if you'd shown me the speakership battle and all the stuff that's going on back in 1995 as a futuristic movie, I would've been like, oh yeah, when's the asteroid gonna hit? It would've seemed sci-fi. So we're used to this kind of thing now. That really started with the 1994 election. But Americans have always hated on Congress. It's just that our hatred has become extraordinarily powerful. The third political verity that the contract Republicans violated was attacking the opponent is what wins elections. And that's kind of a corollary of don't paint a target on your back, right? Don't offer policy specifics, but attack. The Republicans did attack They did attack Bill Clinton. They did obstruct in Congress, particularly in the last couple months before the election, when they basically ground Congress to a halt. And that was one of the things that dipped congressional approval ratings down to the 23% that it was right before the election. But they broke all three of those rules. Of those three rules, the idea that you don't paint a target on your back has come back, because that still speaks to underlying human dynamics. It's still a problem to give people too many specifics, because there's going to be a hater for one or two of those points, and that's going to lose you people. So that idea of the contract, that went away. That was not a revolution. That was an attempt at a transformation that was very specific to that particular time. Attacking the opponent is what wins elections, not offering policy solutions. That has obviously also come back in style, in greater vogue than ever. So it was really only the first aspect of the contract, which was the nationalizing of congressional elections. And that actually did change political dynamics. And now both parties run on a nationalized platform. And if you try to make politics local, it's very difficult to do so. Whenever the in-party is facing obstruction and difficulties, their party leaders try to get their candidates to speak to local issues, to speak to the constituents, but the out-party won't let them. Because that's the problem, is that these guys are governing like bozos, or they're failing to govern. Even if the in-party tries to return to the all politics is local, the out-party now knows. No, there is a playbook that is time-tested and proven now, which is nationalize the campaign. If you're going to try to get your candidates to focus people on local issues, the out party is going to be like, no, 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 let's look back here at how broken Congress is. And because we have a very nationalized media now, local newspapers are largely gone, local news coverage is, you know, focused more on human interest stories and sports, cable news, social media, all of those things make it very difficult to localize politics and very easy to nationalize. So that's one of the things that happened for the first time in 1994 that's now stupendously familiar to us. But that was a big part of why the Republicans were able to win. It was very difficult, given the electoral landscape, for Republicans to win in a district-by-district battle, because for the most part, Americans lean left of center on the issues, and when candidates, local candidates, focus on the specific issues that their constituency cares about, they could campaign and win on those particular issues. And so localized politics not only was the way it went for 60 years, Tip O'Neill was right, it was an effective strategy for Democrats that Republicans tore up that playbook. However much you might want to return to that, the genie's out of the bottle in the nationalized campaigns. What changed in Congress after the Republicans won this uphill battle? It was a huge challenge. What changed was that there was a shift in the center of gravity from committees to the leadership team. And that was really just a result of the procedural reforms that Newt Gingrich wanted, because it would speak to the American people, but he really wanted it because what he wanted is he wanted a powerful leadership team. For 60 plus years, the Democrats ran Congress, ran the House particularly, and the Speaker was a powerful-ish figure, but it really was committee chairs who were in charge of, they were the choke points for legislation, they were the ones who made things happen, and for the most part, they were old, long-serving, 20, 26, 30-year veterans in extremely safe seats. During the heyday of Democratic control, many of them were Southern Democrats who were very socially conservative, and they held their seats because the solid South way back in the day was solid for the Democrats. And so these Southern Democrats had these very safe seats. They had seniority. They ran these committees like their own personal fiefdoms. One of the benefits of the committee system, though, and the reason why the committee system exists in Congress, is it distributes the labor, and it creates the ability to have a legislative agenda that's across several dozen committees with people who are on those committees who have policy expertise, and they can work with the majority and minority party members who are on that committee to come to agreements without having to really make things all about the party platform and the party's reputation. The committee system really does, while it created these fiefdoms for these powerful committee chairs, it really does also create the ability to have a multi-pronged legislative agenda. When you take away the powers of committee chairs by, one, reducing their inflow into the eventual vote for bills, two, put in term limits for committee chairs, which is one of the biggest things that Republicans did, and three, assign from the leadership post people to those committees who aren't necessarily experts, but who are part of why you stay in the leadership team, the entire construction of the way committees work in Congress was changed very radically by Newt Gingrich and the Republicans. And it was kind of a very insider baseball quiet thing. The idea of it appealed to Americans. Congress is broken, let's fix it. What a leadership-centric type of legislative system does, however, is a couple things. One, it slows down the legislative process because the leadership team is not just the choke point for legislation, which it used to be under the old committee system. The speaker still had to bring things to the floor, but it is the locus of deal making and bill formation. And the leadership team, even if they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which they don't, there's only so much they can do. So the agenda, the legislative agenda of the party in control of Congress gets shrunk down just by time scarcity and labor power scarcity. The other thing about the leadership team is that they're expecting party line votes from their members who didn't have a whole lot to do with these bills. So the role of rank and file members has essentially become to be a yes vote. My son, who's a political junkie, forced me to watch the entire speakership battle last January, and it was a good experience, and I ended up having to thank him for it. Part of what was happening with the Republican rebels in their speeches is they were constantly talking about returning to regular order. They were constantly talking about how much rank and file members had just become, you know, yes votes. They were just asked to vote yes. They wouldn't even often have time to read the bill that they were expected to vote yes on. These complaints were totally disingenuous in my view because they were not actually looking to reinstall regular order and in fact have not, but they were on point. They were correct because they were describing something that used to happen in Congress that hadn't happened for decades. And their complaint was, if disingenuous, utterly legitimate. It is true that the establishment became different pretty much immediately after 1994. Another thing that Newt Gingrich did, which further choked down the legislative process and further solidified power in the leadership team and further resulted in party line voting and fewer deals between members of the different parties, is he shortened the congressional work week to 3 days. Congress, before the Republicans took over, worked 5 days a week. But they were expected to be in town, and they were expected to also often stay over the weekend. It wasn't the norm that you flew out on Thursday evening and you flew back in on Tuesday morning for a 3-day legislative work week. And there were a number of things about the old system, which was that if you only had 2 days off, you weren't going to go home very often. So usually you were going to actually have a home in Washington, D.C. You were going to have your family in Washington, D.C. And you were going to hang out with and party with people in Congress who often were from the other party. There was a culture of sort of congressional togetherness that was a result of that schedule and sort of the traditions. When you fly out on Thursday evening and come back on Tuesday morning and only work for 3 days, not only do you not move your family to Washington, D.C., and your spouse does not have over spouses and kids from the other party or from all kinds of people, and you get those human connections that allow you to see them as human beings and not as political enemies, but also you just don't have that much time to work on bills, and you don't have even time to read bills, which is pretty much what Newt Gingrich wanted. He wanted to transform the rank and file basically into just yes votes that were on his side. Part of the reason why the congressional work week was shortened also, though, was to retain the majority. The Republicans are like, we got this majority. Oh my God, we gotta keep this. A big part of it was to send members home to be able to raise money and to maintain the home fires. Even though the contract Republicans had overthrown the all politics is local idea, they still knew that you had to win votes back in your district. And so you had more than half the week to raise money and tend the home fires. The idea that members of Congress were spending more time on their reelection prospects than they were on actual legislating really is a result of procedural reforms that took place after the 1994 midterm election. We get a lot of things out of that. Party leaders who negotiate these bills with party leaders in the other chamber and with the president, they are interested in the top line party agenda. And they're not going to be negotiating things that rank and file members care about. They're not going to be negotiating things from the point of view of, let's try to, you know, win as many votes as we possibly can. Everyone in our party is expected to vote yes for these things. We have the majority. We're going to do it. If it's a unified government, we're going to just work together with the White House and the Senate and the House, and we're going to craft these partisan bills. If it's divided government, we're going to get what we can possibly. If you're the out party, you're not going to cooperate. And the reason you're not going to cooperate is this, is that another big change that occurred in Congress following the 1994 election is that the majorities that were enjoyed by the majority party had narrowed significantly. For the 60 years of Democratic dominance, the average majority, average, was 107 seats. That's astounding. The House of Representatives is 435 members. Your average majority is 107 more seats than the opposing party. That means, one, you can let members of your party vote no on certain bills because you don't need all those votes. You can let a lot of members of your party go. Two, it means that the members of the out party, in this case the Republican Party, they know they're not going to take control of the House or the Senate. And so knowing that, they actually have an incentive to, instead of obstruct, they have an incentive to work in whatever ways they can, through personal relationships, through committee membership, through compromise of their own, to get some of their policy ideas into those bills. When you have narrow majorities and a shortened work week and a leadership-centric legislative process, as the out party, your best, smartest political strategy is to obstruct and to hope that the American people are fed up enough, and not even the American people, just people in about 5% of the districts are fed up enough to vote for the other party. In the divided era from 1994 to the present, the average size of the majority has been 32. The change in seats, the flip in the number of seats average per election, has gone down also, but not that significantly. During the 60 years previous, the average number of seats that changed was 24. And the average number of elections that resulted in the Democrats gaining seats and the Republicans was about even. In the 30 elections during the 60-year period, Democrats picked up seats in 15 of them, Republicans picked up seats in 14 of them, and there was one year where it was a total wash. But there was still an average of 24 seats flipping from one party to the other. So if the Republicans won the election, gained seats in that election, they gained an average of 24 seats. If the Democrats won, they gained an average of 24 seats. But that only flips the majority by 48. That's a net gain of 48. When the average majority is 107, it's rare, if ever, that it's going to flip. And statistically, it never flips. During the divided era, the average number of seats that flips is 19, which is down from 24. There are fewer competitive seats for a lot of reasons. Gerrymandering has to do with that. Targeted campaigning has to do with that. Citizens United, outside money has a lot to do. There's a lot of reasons why it's gone down, but that's not that huge of a difference. But if you, on average, flip 19 seats, that's a net gain of 38. When the average majority is 32, that's actually every election, on average, there's a flip. Now, there hasn't been a flip every election. On average, there's been a flip every 3 election cycles, which is not a lot. If you're in the minority and you see the majority, even if they have a decent-sized majority, like, say, 50 seats instead of 32, you can hope to flip the chamber. And when you can hope every single time to flip the chamber, your incentive to work with the majority party is negative. And people who suggest it are laughed out of the room and often pushed out of the party. So obstruction becomes the order of the day. So obstruction, which we're so used to, we're just totally used to this, is a result of, one, the new legislative style of the post-Contract with America Congress, which Republicans inaugurated with their procedural reforms, but Democrats have more or less, there's slightly different rules that Democrats put in place when they take the majority than when Republicans take the majority, and there's been some movement here and there over the years, but fundamentally the leadership-centric process is in place. It's possible, and I'm gonna wait a few years to see if it pans out, but it's possible that what's going on right now with the Republicans in the House of Representatives is going to lead to a transformation of congressional procedure away from a leadership-centric, because the leadership-centric system is clearly now very problematic, even for the leaders. I'm not optimistic that we're going to see a big change, because it would require, I would say, a kind of a grassroots effort by rank and file members to reestablish a committee-centric type of system. And there are all kinds of problems in, one, achieving that, and two, making that a better system. Because it wasn't necessarily a great system in the heyday. It was a system that meant that you had to spend 10 years minimum in Congress before anyone would even listen to you. They'd invite you to their barbecues, and your kids and your wife would come to their house. It was always the wife, because the men dominated Congress at that point. But they weren't going to necessarily incorporate your ideas until you'd been there for a decade or more. That is definitely not the way things go now. Because of this, there's one other thing that we're very familiar with that is a result of this particular era. And that is the fact that budget showdowns and government shutdowns are not only common and frequent, they are pretty much the most high-profile piece of what Congress is about. And that is not just perception based on media reporting. The media definitely loves a good, juicy conflict and story, so of course these stories get reported, but it really is actually the thing that takes up the greatest bandwidth of congressional action, except for in the Senate confirming nominations, which takes up a lot of bandwidth, but that doesn't make the papers unless it's a Supreme Court justice. But that's a lot of what the Senate does. The reason for that is when you can't move bills, when your legislative agenda is narrowed down to maybe one or two legislative victories. I just read that Mitch McConnell, he's stepping down from his leadership role. His legislative accomplishments are practically nothing, despite the fact that he's the longest serving Senate leader in history. But his political accomplishments are tremendous, but his legislative accomplishments are practically nothing. When you can't move legislation, the budget becomes where you fight policy. When you know that you can't get a major piece of legislation through, the way that you change the way the federal government behaves is by raising and lowering funding for certain programs, raising and lowering funding for enforcement of certain rules, by putting policy riders into the budget. When that's your one opportunity to get policy done, of course budget battles are going to go from tough to horrific and mean-spirited and bare-knuckle politics. So the reason why we have more showdowns and also on average more shutdowns, we know at least we've lived in sort of perpetual budget crisis this entire year and really this entire decade and really almost this entire century. That makes sense. And so if there's one thing that you take out of today's lecture, it is that the reason why Congress is so horrifically broken looking and broken, right? I'll say broken looking and broken. It's both of those things, and both of those things are important, is because of the procedural changes that took place as a result of the 1994 election. The shortened work week, to me, is kind of the most hidden secret. Like, we know that this is people who follow Congress know that this is a feature of the legislative calendar, but to know that it happened at a specific point and that what are the consequences when you sort of pencil out what happens when members of Congress no longer are there all week, they're no longer there over the weekends, their families aren't there. It contributes culturally to the polarization. So, that's the 1994 election.